Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Cure Talks Cancer podcast. Each week, we'll be hearing from patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, and healthcare professionals to do what Cure does best: provide cancer updates, research, and education. Cancer is bleak. In a single moment, a diagnosis can force us to stare down the abyss of our own mortality. It's not the kind of thing that anyone enjoys doing or even thinking about. In fact, death and dying are among the greatest taboos in our culture. Not only do we tend not to embrace the idea of our own death, despite it being inevitable, we expend great effort as a society actively avoiding it in any way we can. Now, I think that's understandable, because for many of us, life and everything that it's made of, love, family, friendships, hardships, work, play, hobbies, challenges, and dreams, all of these things are worth cherishing. And if death means the absence of all those things we cherish, why shouldn't we avoid it at all costs? The answer? Because sometimes we don't have a choice. And that's the hard truth about cancer. Even when we fight with every ounce of our being, and when we frame things differently in our minds, and even when we make the most of every amazing moment we have on this earth, all things, good and bad, must come to an end. But fortunately, that's not the end of this story. Even when we're facing the end of life, hope springs eternal. Consider this. What if, in the face of all the stigma that currently surrounds the end of life, there is a way to live out the rest of our days free from anxiety, depression, sadness, and fear? What if, instead of feeling that the end of life is something cold, dark, and lonely, we could know deeply that the end of this journey is simply the beginning of a new one, and it's laid out right there, right in front of us, like a red carpet? Now, admittedly, this is a very different way of looking at things for most of us modern death-fearing humans. But this new way of thinking and seeing the world, life and death, it's exactly what's promised by a treatment that has reemerged in the mainstream research pipeline following thousands of years of traditional use, a 40-year plunge into darkness, and now a recent research renaissance that has some experts claiming it could achieve FDA approval within the next 5 years. This treatment is called psilocybin. If you haven't heard this name before, and even if you have, I'm going to ask you to leave your preconceived notions at the door when I tell you that psilocybin is the psychoactive ingredient found in magic mushrooms. Now, that phrase raises all sorts of imagery in our minds, some of it good, some of it bad, but almost none of that imagery is useful for the discussion that we're going to have today, and none of it is relevant to patients with cancer who are looking to learn more about the possibilities. Does psilocybin bring on hallucinations? Yes, it can. Is it extremely powerful? Yes, it is. Is it wrapped up in a web of complex stigma dating back to the 1950s? Absolutely yes. Does it deserve the strange, bad rap that it's gotten in the decades since? Maybe not. And why not? Because mounting scientific evidence suggests that psilocybin can help patients with cancer overcome depression, anxiety, and fear, and embrace their uncertain future in a way that current treatments simply cannot. According to some patients who have taken psilocybin in guided sessions with a therapist, the experience was the most meaningful of their life. Just one session resulted in profound changes in thinking that made it easier to understand and accept the finite nature of being. Tony Bossis, PhD, is the Director of Palliative Care Research with psilocybin, head of the Cancer Anxiety Project, and clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at NYU. Along with a handful of colleagues across the US, he's leading the so-called psilocybin research renaissance we alluded to earlier. The findings of that research are really promising. They've caught the attention of the FDA, which Bossis says is likely to approve psilocybin within 5 to 7 years as a palliative treatment for patients with cancer. Today on the Cure Talks Cancer podcast, we welcome Tony Bossis to the show to talk more about what patients with cancer need to know about psilocybin, where the misconceptions lie, and what is ultimately at stake. Right off the bat, I know that there are tons of misconceptions out there about not only psilocybin, but also palliative care. So we're dealing with two separate elements here, where patients with cancer, they hear certain things, but I don't think many people, myself included, have a very clear picture on how these two things are intertwined, what either of them are. So let's start off with setting some sort of ground rule, foundational elements here, Tony. What is psilocybin and what is palliative care and what is their relationship?
That's a great way to start to kind of frame these names, because people do, as you say, there's certainly a lot of misinterpretation or misunderstanding of what both are. So psilocybin is a naturally occurring compound that's found in specific species of mushrooms that grow on the earth. Turns out this compound psilocybin found in the mushroom when humans eat it, and it's been known for millennia, been used in indigenous cultures for various spiritual and traditional framework, can alter consciousness in a very profound way and trigger what we call a mystical experience. And we'll come back to that in a few minutes. So it's a naturally occurring compound known as a psychedelic or a hallucinogen that's been known throughout history to be used in traditional and religious purposes. But now we're using it in science and research to trigger this state that it's been shown to have clinical efficacy and safety in certain populations. One of them is addiction, but one of them, of course, we know is working with people in palliative care, people who are at the end of life with end-of-life distress. It has an incredible history, psilocybin. Aside from its indigenous history, back in the 50s and 60s of the last century, research began in America with psychedelics that many people don't know about. People hear the word magic mushrooms or psychedelics and think of the 1960s. And one of the misunderstandings, unfortunately, is that people think that's the entire picture of what magic mushrooms or LSD is. And that's a very small part of a very much larger history. That's a couple of years during a cultural, very big cultural shift in our country. But psilocybin and these medicines go back before that, and we use in the 50s and 60s for very serious clinical research with end-of-life populations. The early research in the 1960s and the 50s was that one experience, one dose of psilocybin, triggering this mystical peak experience, and I'll define that in a few minutes, could profoundly recalibrate someone's end-of-life experience, reducing anxiety and depression, and a host of other measures that we'll come back to when I discuss the research. So that's psilocybin, and it's now being used in clinical trials throughout the world to see if we could really replicate some of these findings on its efficacy and safety with certain clinical populations. Palliative care also, as you pointed out well, Tom, is often misunderstood. People hear the word palliative care or the words palliative care and think of, you know, hospice or the very end of life, and it's not that. Palliative care is an interdisciplinary field in medicine that really addresses a person's clinical or social or spiritual or medical needs when diagnosed with a potentially life-threatening disease. So anywhere along the trajectory of being diagnosed, people can utilize palliative care services in hospital settings and outpatient settings for a variety of measures: pain control, medical needs, psychological needs, spiritual needs. We work with clergy very often. So palliative care is a very, you know, broader discipline than most people think it is. And the intersection of the two, which is what I've been doing for the past decade, which is this remarkable, bringing those two together, is that the psilocybin experience, or this mystical experience, defined broadly as a sense of unity that people have, a sense of transcendence, a profound sense of meaning-making, and we'll get into that a little more, has been used in this population going back 50, 60, 70 years. And in the past 10 years, there's been a resurgence of this research, thankfully, at UCLA, at Johns Hopkins, and where I am at NYU, looking at how one session with this medicine can significantly help people with end-of-life anxiety, and I can discuss the results of that finding in a few minutes. But that's kind of a broad strokes of those two topics. Psilocybin being part of this incredible medicine family called psychedelics, and palliative care being this very important discipline that's getting more more attention, thankfully, in a culture of helping those with life-threatening and end-of-life distress.
So you raised a bunch of interesting points there, Tony, especially going back to the 50s and 60s. I know we saw some really fantastic results when we were researching psychedelics and its ability to help people kick addictions like to alcohol. But since then, you know, these therapies, they've been put on a Schedule I list, right? So the same list that marijuana is on, the same list that heroin is on.
Right.
Why are we even talking about these drugs if they're on that list in the context of cancer care? Can you sort of clear the air on that?
Yeah, that's great. And it allows me to back up a bit and continue to kind of place it in the proper frame. So in the 1950s and 60s, psilocybin and LSD were both available. LSD is man-made to the awareness of the West in the late 1950s. At that time, both compounds or medicines were legal. They were not illegal. And because of this profound altered state, the shift in consciousness that these medicines or these compounds can produce, they were immediately looked into, could there be medical value in these states? One of the things of the early research was that the shift that occurred seemed to mimic or mirror what we know throughout history, what's called, again, the mystical or peak experience. And I'll walk through some of the criteria. There aren't a lot. The subjective features of a person taking this medicine for this one session for a 3 or 4 hour period are one of a unity that all things are connected, a sense of profound sacredness, a sense of transcendence, very important in end-of-life care, and that it allows or provides a person to have the subjective experience that they're not just this body or this cancer, that they get this shift in perspective that transcends body, even transcends what we call time and space. And that sounds, I know, very, I guess, far out there, but that's how they experience this. A sense of ineffability, it's impossible to describe. And these features we find also in mystical experience that are at the heart of the world's religious traditions. They also occur naturally throughout time. A recent Pew Research study found that 49% of people reported have some type of peak or mystical experience in their lifetime, that sense of transcendent or meaning-making. So early on, these medicines provided these experiences, and researchers began to think, could this be useful in treating various disorders or various forms of suffering? And the two main arms of research to come out of the early research in the 50s and the 60s was one with alcoholism, people with very severe addiction presentations, and how one dose could provide this incredibly transcendent, meaning-making experience that served as an ablation to drink again. Many people don't know that Bill Wilson, who founded AA, actually had many of these experiences, and that's part of the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. The other arm to grow out of it was with cancer patients. As we know, and we'll talk about today, we don't die well in America. We don't treat end-of-life properly. It seems to be the final taboo, talking about death or end of life or even being ill. And people with cancer and other medical disorders, you know, for years we haven't really addressed that in an open cultural way. So the early research began giving psilocybin and LSD, which is similar in its experience, to people with advanced cancer, terminal cancer. And they found one session with this medicine in a very interpersonally supported, safe setting, and we'll come back to that as well, in a very safe environment by professional therapists, could produce this experience, which they found immediately had a dramatic reduction in depression and anxiety, demoralization, hopelessness, a host of measures that are very difficult that people can have when they have cancer or a serious illness. Unfortunately, with the 1960s kind of cultural phenomena and shift and the recreational use of these psychedelic medicines, in 1970, President Nixon signed into law a congressional act making these medicines not only illegal, because until then they were legal actually, but out of the reach of research, which was really remarkable. So never before or since in the history of medicine as a compound that's been looked at for potential healing or therapeutic purposes, been rendered out of the reach of medical research because of a cultural phenomenon. But that's what happened. And for 30 years or so, there was no research at all. Now we're finding ourselves in a very, people call it a renaissance period, of investigating the safety, the efficacy of these compounds. Can they be useful, and how can they help us? And so three sites in America, my site at NYU, Johns Hopkins, and UCLA, began administering psilocybin again to cancer patients, and found again that with one dose, with one session that's embedded within a brief psychotherapeutic period done properly with professional therapists, dramatically reduced end-of-life suffering. And we published our studies in 2016 at Johns Hopkins at NYU, and UCLA published a smaller study in 2011 showing that the one session reduced depression, anxiety, hopelessness, demoralization, and also improved spiritual well-being, which was remarkable. People had a greater sense of general well-being, of existential well-being. Many people reported it being the most important experience of their lifetime in terms of meaning-making or spirituality. So the results are very compelling and got the attention of the medical and popular community. And that's where we are today. We're at the next phase of generating more studies to show that, hopefully show that psilocybin could trigger a state for, again, the one session to reduce the suffering of people at the end of life or with cancer. And then the important thing, there's two important things to note here, that one, this medicine, which I'll call it a medicine, is very different from most of the medicines people take. So most medicine people take daily, they take every day to have the desired effect, continue or sustain. This they take once. But it's the experience, this meaning-making, transcendent experience, and the memories of it that seems to just recalibrate and change dramatically how people view self, death, consciousness, and it's those changes that seem to be enduring, which is quite remarkable. The second thing, it's not really a drug study per se only. It's about the experience, not the drug. So these experiences have been happening naturally throughout history. People have naturally occurring peak or mystical or numinous experiences of transcendence and meaning-making, these spiritual awakenings, some people call them, but they can be generated with these medicines as well. So it's a very exciting and compelling time for the research.
So Tony, I'd love to zoom into some of the patients that you're dealing with and their experiences. So can you tell us about some of the feedback you get from these patients after a guided session with psilocybin? What sort of challenges do they have coming into this therapeutic moment? And what reactions do they have? How do they view their experience afterwards?
That's a great question. So, and thank you for saying the word guided. So I want to reiterate for any listeners that these medicines aren't just given to someone and they take it on their own. These medicines are used recreationally, unfortunately, in ways that could provide, could induce panic or anxiety when not done properly. In the context of medical settings, they're done in a very interpersonally supportive setting where people are screened and they're prepared. We get to know them for a few weeks, prepare them for the session itself. The session takes place in a lovely room in the hospital where they feel safe. They take the medicine, lie down on a couch of sorts, and for a number of hours, they lie there with two therapists with them, and as they go into the unfolding changes in consciousness. So then there's a follow-up period for weeks of integrative psychotherapy. So these are, very controlled experiments or clinical trials. So as you know, working with cancer patients, the presentations are varied. We had 80 patients between the Hopkins and NYU study, and people come in with, the kinds of thing we hear that people struggle with towards the end of life, a lack of meaning, a fear of the unknown, a fear of, losing this life that we have, lacking a capacity to be present for people in their life, of course, fear of more pain and disability. And the spiritual and psychosocial anguish can be quite remarkable. And modern medicine, in terms of antidepressants, doesn't really get at that. That could clip or cut off some of the depressive parts of the experience, but it doesn't change the meaning of it, the meaning of having this life come to its end. And so we see in a variety of presentations around that kind of suffering that end of life can trigger. And of course, if people are young, and we see people young in our study, we see people in their 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s with cancer, and it's quite a struggle to contend with that kind of diagnosis and look at the end of your life when you're still hopefully thought you were in the middle of it. The experiences we get back are just very, very varied. So one is, of course, I mentioned some of the clinical changes and depression, anxiety, all that, and that's crucial. But I think what you're getting at is, what do they tell us in addition to these changes in their symptoms? And it is the remarkable part. So many people report very interesting perspectives on consciousness. And we don't think about that a lot as we walk through our lives, but you know, what is consciousness? You know, where is consciousness? How does this all work? And people report, you know, really dramatic shifts in understanding that and insights that maybe it doesn't end when the body ends. They tap into what the religions would call this kind of perennial philosophy, this enduring sense of self. Other people report a profound sense of love, and it's always been interesting to talk about love as a scientist, but it comes up a lot in our research. People speaking about this incredible sense of the importance of love, not only towards themselves and towards others, but that life itself, that's the most important, the essence of who we are. And so these kinds of experiences really changes how they live and how they see death. One of the most remarkable byproducts of that is their capacity to live fully in the moment, even with a year or two or years to live. There's less of the dread of what's coming and more of a sense to be present in the present moment, which of course we hear like in terms of mindfulness meditation. The goal of meditation and mindfulness is our capacity to be mindfully present. Most suffering for all of us is worrying about things that have happened in the past or worrying about things that haven't happened yet. And it's always a struggle to be rooted in the present moment. And the shift in consciousness that they have does seem to reorder that capacity to be more present. A very touching thing people often speak about is a sense of forgiveness towards themselves of the things they've done in their life and also for others. So we see these kind of interpersonal changes happen where people will then go back and speak to someone else from their life and talk about forgiveness and forgive and accept people's forgiveness. And that's quite touching to hear people kind of revisit various parts of their lifespan and come to peace with what might have been years or decades of regret or resentment or of conflict. So that's always touching to hear stories about love and forgiveness. And then there's these spiritual insights that, again, we're more than maybe this body, and that we're not identified by our disease or our cancer, that we're more complex, and there's something more enduring within each of us. So these are, you know, very kind of transpersonal and spiritual insights, but they have such profound implications. And we follow these patients for months afterwards, and not for years. And in our 2016 publication, we found that going up to 8 months, these effects were sustained. People, you know, sustained these low levels of depression, anxiety, and then we're tracking them years later, and we'll publish a paper next year, I think, looking at how these have changed, you know, how these have been sustained years later. So it's quite remarkable how the one session, this one experience can change someone's outlook on themselves, and of course their illness, and big things like death and love.
Looking at death specifically, you said in the beginning of this conversation, Tony, that in America we don't die well. So yeah. How could a therapy like this help change that?
Well, it's a great question. Our hope is that, so in terms of the future of this in the next 5 or 10 years, we're hoping to repeat these studies the next year or so, again, giving psilocybin, again, one or two sessions at most to people in palliative care, people with an illness that is potentially life-threatening, and because of that triggers a fair amount of anxiety or depression in that person. And if those studies replicate the earlier findings, which were quite substantial, the findings we achieve were never seen before in the history of medicine. You don't get the kind of drop-off of depression, anxiety in one session from any other kind of experience or medicine. If they go as well and the results and the safety are repeated, we're hopeful in between 5 and 10 years, that psilocybin, which is now Schedule 1, you mentioned earlier, so Schedule 1 means there's no medical use for this medicine. We're allowed to use it in clinical trials supported by the FDA, but there's no supported use in healthcare. They would change its scheduling. That would be changed to a schedule where that, while it's not available for public use, it would be available for prescription in a controlled setting like other medications are. So the hope is that within 5 or 10 years, we can have psilocybin-generated experiences integrated into palliative care. You know, could there be centers where people can come and spend a week, a week and a half, and be prepared and have an experience, and then return to their home following this experience? And that's been kind of the goal for decades. You know, could these centers exist that are regulated and government controlled and with trained therapists for people to come to have these medicines, and have an experience in a guided therapeutic fashion, and then return to their home, ideally, of course, with the benefits of that session? That would be the hope for how it would be integrated within palliative care, which is very, very exciting. You know, palliative care has done made incredible progress in the past 10, 15 years. But again, in our country, we still kind of don't talk about death. It's still kind of the ultimate taboo, although we've made some really great shifts in terms of that cultural conversation, which is healthier to do that. And so, you know, my hope is that this will be one tool. And again, it's not for everyone, but that'll be one therapeutic tool to be used treating the existential and psychological distress that people in palliative care, you know, often experience.
So when we look at this in the next few years, like you mentioned, I know you have studies ongoing. What are the biggest questions that you're hoping to answer?
So, I mean, one of the things we want to change, of course, is the scheduling when it's appropriate. So, again, we look at safety. So, one of the big questions is, you know, how safe are all these? So far, we know them to be very safe when done in the proper setting. One of the concerns we have is that when not done in this proper setting, it can be a very different experience. So, we want to continue to kind of look into it and find ways to, you know, increase these trials when they become rescheduled, hopefully in 5 or 10 years, to be sustained in these safe settings. You know, we'd like to know more about, you know, why some people have these mystical experiences, some don't. So everyone doesn't have the same experience. So how does our history and our own personal history affect the outcome of the medicine session? And, you know, and also one of the main barriers for us has been to help educate the healthcare community, the public about these medicines. Again, because of the 1960s and all the kind of cultural backlash from psychedelics, sadly got a very kind of bad name, and for many reasons that are understandable. But these medicines, when used in this way, are very different medicines with a very different therapeutic model. So we're looking to know more about safety, about efficacy. Are there populations that should not be using these? So we do rule out a fair amount of people with certain kinds of brain tumors, certain kinds of hypertension. If it's untreated, couldn't be used. So we want to really kind of narrow down our capacity to know who could benefit the most and what kind of medical histories would be contraindicated for this therapeutic approach.
Okay, and for patients with cancer who are listening in, who are maybe interested in learning more about this, is there any way they can get involved potentially in the trials, or have those already been set? How can they learn more about this?
That's a great question. So right now, there are no trials going on right now. So we do get a lot of calls and emails, people looking for clinical studies. There are, you know, many books now out, and that's raised the public's awareness of these medicines. And so right now we're between clinical trials. I hope within the next year or year and a half to start a new multi-site study looking at people, not only with cancer, but in palliative care, so with cancer or other diagnoses that are potentially life-threatening and hence causing some emotional distress. So for now, there isn't much the public can do. You know, I hope maybe through even, you know, Cure Media, that when the studies begin, I'd be happy to, you know, let you know, and you could post that on various sites. But right now we're between studies, so, you know, that's been actually a very tough part of this one of the tough parts of the experience, Tom, people have been emailing and calling looking for studies, and because they're illegal and only available in clinical trials, and they're far and few between right now, that there are no current, there's no current availability. But I hope within a year, by end of 2020, that's changed in terms of more clinical trials going on in the country. And there'll probably be five or seven sites that we'll be using.
Before we part ways, are there any final sort of nuggets of wisdom you may have for cancer patients just who may have not heard about this previously, more ways they can get involved in either supporting this or connecting with you?
Yeah, so it's a good question. And also I want to add, people often ask, what can we learn from these psilocybin-generated experiences for everyday life? And I think it's an important question. And you know, what we learn from these experiences, from people who, what they tell us, is that it triggers things that we all know to be true anyway, a sense of forgiveness and finding meaning. You know, research for years has shown that meaning-making in the context of cancer or palliative care diagnosis is profoundly transformative and helpful with treating the end of life or cancer-associated distress. So, you know, people should always, I mean, there are other ways to find meaning than, of course, this medicine. We find meaning in our children, in our hobbies, in our spiritual paths. In terms of the medicine, you know, again, we're in clinical trial stages, and there isn't much the public can do except, you know, if they hear of these trials, to support them and to rethink what these are. Some of the popular books have helped with this, that although they're dangerous psychologically to do recreationally without the proper setting, they've been profoundly shown to be safe in a therapeutic, safe medical setting. So that if people hear of clinical trials, then they should clearly see if they meet the criteria for a trial. Between that, there's not much people can do, Tom. Right now, it's between the government and our trials showing efficacy, and hopefully within 5 years or 7 years or a little longer, we will be in a place where we can reschedule this ideally and have it more available. So until then, it's a bit frustrating to have these medicines being shown to have efficacy and safety, yet them being not available for the majority of people in the country. Patients is what we're working with, and hopefully we'll get there soon enough.
Yeah, what has to happen legislatively for those steps to be taken?
Right, so that's pretty straightforward. So again, so in terms of research, there are different phases of clinical research and clinical trials the FDA supports and approves. So we've reached phase two, of the research ladder, so to speak. A larger clinical trial would have to take place, which we're just beginning that process. And after the what's called phase three trials, and right now there are trials also with psilocybin with depression beginning as well. And when those trials are completed and approved, only then can the FDA reschedule that, finding this medicine to have shown enough safety and efficacy in a large enough sample, not just dozens, but a much larger group of people. Then at that point, and only at that point, can the FDA say, well, this is, you know, clearly a relatively safe medicine, been researched in peer-reviewed research and with a large enough sample to reschedule it and approve it as a medicine to be used in healthcare. That takes a fair amount of regulatory changes, and that's the path we're on, and that's what we're looking at. And that's why some of the recreational use that we read about and some of the states are decriminalizing these medicines, you know, that's very different from what we're doing. We're following FDA guidelines to hopefully one day reschedule these on a federal level to make it a medicine for people who are suffering.
Yeah, and, you know, I'll be following along very closely as that process happens, Tony, and hopefully we can stay in touch throughout that. Is there anything maybe that you think that we haven't touched on that you think is important to address before we go?
Well, there's a lot on this topic. You know, one is palliative care in general, that people, if they are diagnosed with cancer, that they know that they should be aware that there's help for them. So it's often to feel isolated. It's easy to feel alone in the diagnosis. But again, palliative care is not hospice care. Hospice care is an incredible domain of clinical services, but that's more geared towards people at the end of life. And while palliative care and hospice care, you know, overlap, of course, in many ways, palliative care is much broader umbrella. You know, most hospitals in the country now, which is a shift from many, many years ago, have palliative care clinics and centers where there's a host of medical, psychological and spiritual resources to utilize for both physical and emotional spiritual suffering that a diagnosis like this can trigger. And so that's important for all listeners who might be struggling with an illness. And you know that's crucial. And that, you know, there's a lot of meaning making to be found not only in these medicines but also in life itself, and in psychotherapies and our spiritual frameworks and in our loved ones. So, you know, what I've been touched by in all these patients in our research is that despite the level of suffering that cancer diagnosis can trigger, and many of our patients have since passed away who are at the end of life, that our capacity and our resilience is quite remarkable as humans. And so it's difficult, but you know, and encourage people to seek out palliative care, and I hope these medicines are rescheduled before too long, but we're very encouraged by the early findings.
Awesome. Well, Tony, thanks so much for bringing this to light. I think the work you're doing is fantastic, and I really appreciate you joining us on the Cure Talks Cancer Podcast.
Thank you, Tom. I will let you know when things change. You've asked a few times, what could people do? We're kind of in this in-between stage. There isn't much the public can do, but I will certainly keep you updated and as trials begin.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cure Talks Cancer Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and any other apps to hear every episode, or visit us at curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cure Talks Cancer Podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, your indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com. Find us on Twitter @Cure_Magazine or Facebook at Cure Magazine.